I indeed believe that free markets are the best way to end global poverty, not government action.
Markets on their own pervasively, persistently fail to move people out of poverty or to achieve economic efficiency.
State-dominated societies will often see an elite capture the state and be able to oppress the rest of the population through state-sanctioned coercion.
The preconditions for development are infrastructure, education, transfers of technology, health, all areas in which markets don't work well.
The problem with our government is that they're completely captured by the corporations. The corporations run the government. And then they ask, you know, what is the solution to, how do we solve this problem? Well, the government will solve it.
We are truly honored to have a conversation, a special conversation between two deeply informed people. The first is, and I won't give you their long resume, their incredible credentials, speaks for itself. It's all on our website. First, we are honored to have NYU Econ Prof. William Easterly. Professor Easterly, please come to the stage. And, okay. All right, well, Professor Stiglitz, let's hope you get this. Okay, said the same applause, there's an applause, doesn't, no contest there. Okay, and then we are equally honored to have Columbia Econ Prof. Joseph Stiglitz. Professor Stiglitz, please come to the stage. I only want to mention a couple of things that one thing you don't know, which isn't on the website, is that these guys are friends. They've known each other for years, and they don't agree about everything, but they definitely agree about their friendship. And then the only other thing they have in common, which is of interest, is that they're both Midwesterners. Bill was born in West Virginia, but raised in Bowling Green, Ohio, and Joe Stiglitz hails from Gary, Indiana. And you will find on Professor Easterly's website, if you read carefully the last sentence, his big brag is that he's the 11th best-known person from Bowling Green. I won't ask you who were the other 10. Professor Stiglitz, you're upstage that way. You probably don't rank that high. But there is a song called Gary, Indiana from the Music Man, a great song, which you will not sing tonight. Without further ado, I want the question for the conversation of the evening stated again, which is simply, is the best way to end global poverty free markets or government action? The format tonight will not be Oxford-style voting. It's not a formal debate, but it will be a conversation. But we're going to have 10 minutes of introductory remarks from each, and then we're going to have 5 minutes of summary from each. In between, we'll have dialogue between them, and then plenty of opportunity for Q&A. As per agreement, Professor Easterly will go first with a 10-minute introduction. Professor Easterly, please take the podium.
Well, I can't see anybody in the audience. It's dark. Can you hear me in the back okay? I am a soft-spoken guy from Bowling Green, Ohio. So my job tonight, I was assigned to represent the case that I indeed believe that free markets are the best way to end global poverty, not government action. But first, let's avoid the straw man that anyone who advocates free markets believes in some kind of zero role for government. Of course, I recognize there's a role for government, such as providing public services like police and courts. However, the problem in development has usually been too much emphasis on government intervention and too little on markets. So in that sense, I am arguing markets are a much underappreciated way in development of the best way to reduce poverty. I'm going to stress three channels by which markets work well to reduce poverty: better incentives, better use of knowledge, and then most novel is better rights. So let me start with incentives. The most obvious benefit of markets are the incentives to produce goods that create income and that meet consumer needs. State intervention in markets destroys these incentives and creates poverty. Let me start with something that I didn't actually put in my notes, that it's kind of a favorite of mine. Like many of the things I'm going to talk about, these are examples that I can back up with more systematic evidence that we can discuss in the more boring parts of Q&A. I'm going to give you mainly examples. My first favorite example is a picture from Cuba of Fidel Castro's funeral. I don't know if any of you saw this picture. Fidel Castro is being carried in state, pulled by an army jeep on a magnificently bedecked, flower-bedecked trailer with Fidel Castro's coffin. And there were soldiers, of course, marching in the parade, but the soldiers were not marching in the parade. They were pushing the jeep. I'm hoping for a better laugh line than that. Apparently, the incentives, even for Fidel Castro's funeral, were not quite strong enough to make the jeep work. So look that up on the internet. More seriously, I started my development career as a very junior World Bank economist in 1985, visiting Ghana. And Ghana in 1985 was a pretty grim place, and partly because the Ghanaian government had destroyed the economy by severe interventions and price controls. One example of price controls is the price of cocoa paid to cocoa farmers when they sold cocoa was so severely controlled they were only getting 6% of the world price of cocoa was going to the farmers. That is the world price for the raw material of cocoa. They were getting only 6% of that price. Not surprisingly, the cocoa economy of Ghana, that used to be the world's leading producer of cocoa, had collapsed, and a lot of other parts of the Ghanaian economy had collapsed. And so Ghana in 1985 was an extremely poor and dysfunctional place. And it's been one of the pleasures of mine throughout my career to watch Ghana revive as those controls have been lifted and prices and markets have been liberalized in Ghana, and Ghana is today a much happier story with Wi-Fi and the hotel rooms and a middle class and an upper class and a lower working class that is much less poor than it used to be. And that's been arguably a result of the great liberalization of markets that have happened since 1985. Now, of course, that hasn't happened everywhere, but it has happened in a lot of places and has been documented to be statistically associated with the revival of growth in Africa and Latin America in particular since the lost decades of the 80s and 90s in those regions. One exception to that positive trend is today Venezuela. As many of you know, Venezuela still has severe state controls over the economy and is suffering not only poverty, but even starvation for those living in Venezuela. There was a statistic that 74% of the population in 2016 lost on average 19 pounds in 2016 due to the shortages of food created by the state interventions and food price controls in Venezuela. At a personal level, I have a close friend whose mother-in-law lives in Venezuela, and they're desperate on how to rescue her from starving, because not only is she not able to get food in Venezuela, the packages that they send to her are confiscated by the government or stolen. So that's the kind of tragedy that happens with heavy state intervention that doesn't let markets work to relieve poverty. Let me next go to the knowledge channel. A great advantage of markets is they place the decisions in the hands of consumers and entrepreneurs who know best what works for them. Oh, I'm going to need a little more time than that. I'll give Joe extra time too, okay? We don't believe in budget constraints. We're economists.
Reallocation to Joe.
So I completely forgot what I was saying, you. Okay, knowledge channel. Markets place decisions in the hand of consumers and entrepreneurs who know best what works for them. Let me give you an example of what happens when you don't do that. There was a UN-appointed commission called the UN Broadband Commission that was chaired by Rwanda's dictator, Paul Kagame. And Kagame himself set the tone for the commission. He said, "Broadband is so wonderful." He said, "The transformational impact of broadband on people's lives and global economies is no longer questionable. He was ordering us not to question the benefits that the UN top-down commission had decided would be achieved by imposition of broadband everywhere. There was one skeptic that I read with some amusement that the UC Berkeley researcher Kentaro Toyama read some surveys that when a village gets hooked up to the internet on a broadband connection, and this is a quote from Toyama, he said, the dominant use is by young men who are playing games, quote, playing games, watching movies, or consuming adult content. So maybe broadband is not quite as great as Paul Kagame ordered us not to question it was. What actually works at the bottom is often a surprise that is best figured out by those at the bottom, by consumers and entrepreneurs. It turns out that consumers around the world wanted cell phones a lot more than they wanted broadband. Cell phone subscribers have rocketed in sub-Saharan Africa, for example. They now total 444 million subscribers of cell phones, reaching even very poor people in Africa who are able to buy a cell phone in very small incremental minutes at kiosk in every rural area and road by side. And this has had remarkable economic benefits. The firm M-Pesa in Kenya thought it was going to be a microcredit organization, but it found by accident that the service that was most in demand was mobile phone transfers of money from one mobile phone to another, which greatly enhanced and simplified the lives of farmers and traders and gave them a lot of unforeseen benefits that were only discovered through markets by those at the bottom. And M-Pesa now in Kenya produces more transfers than Western Union does worldwide. 6 billion transactions per year in Kenya done by M-Pesa. So that's the kind of surprise that the knowledge of consumers and entrepreneurs at the bottom through markets are able to figure out for themselves. Now let me do the in the 2 minutes remaining to me, let me do...
What, 12 minutes?
No, not that much. Okay. Let me take a swig of water. Okay, the water doesn't count, right? So the third and most novel channel that I want to discuss is how markets promote rights. And so what do I mean by that? State-dominated societies will often see an elite capture the state and be able to oppress the rest of the population through state-sanctioned coercion. Market systems are inherently based on some degree of legal equality of property and contract rights among all the participants in market, including the poorest and the richest. And the reason that is because market transactions will not happen at all unless a minimum level of contract and property rights are recognized on both sides. Otherwise, one party would simply cheat or steal or oppress the other, and there would be no markets. There would simply be cheating, stealing, and oppression. So for markets to exist at all, these kind of rights have to be accepted by all the participants in markets. Now, this is not an original point. There was someone a while ago who saw this point named Adam Smith. Adam Smith commented in 1776 in The Wealth of Nations on the discovery of America, and he said, you know, the discovery of the Americas could have been such a great opportunity for mutual benefits for Europeans and indigenous Americans. You know, Europe had commodities to offer the Americas had new commodities to offer Europe. It could have been a great opportunity for the kind of free trade beloved by Adam Smith. But it was not to be, and this is a quote from Adam Smith. The savage injustice of the Europeans rendered an event which ought to have been beneficial to all, ruinous and destructive to those unfortunate countries. So that's the kind of realization that Smith had, that the benefits of markets are only available when there's a minimum level of legal equality on both sides, which was obviously drastically violated in the Americas, in the conquest of the Americas. And of course, this history is still very relevant today. I just got back from a trip to Peru, in which is very evident from casual observation to an economist or a non-economist that the indigenous Americans are still very much at the bottom, still suffering from the legacy of that oppression 5 centuries ago that has continued to some extent into the present with the capture of the state, Latin American states, by the elite class. But on a more happy note, Smith offered a remarkable prophecy in The Wealth of Nations about how all this oppression would end. And he makes it clear that it would involve respecting the rights of non-Europeans. He said, this is a quote from Adam Smith, "The inhabitants of all different quarters of the world may arrive at some respect for the rights of one another." That's a beautiful phrase that I think captures the essence of markets, respect for the rights of one another. And he said, nothing seems more likely to establish this equality than an extensive commerce from all countries to all countries. And it's this somewhat happy news that in our own generation, this prophecy by Adam Smith has some partially, to some degree, come true. That indeed, Adam Smith was right, that markets are the main way historically, and in our generation of globalized markets and migrants and capital flows, markets are the main way historically and in our generation that different races, peoples, and nations have peacefully coexisted and cooperated for their mutual benefit. And that is, to me, the final and most beautiful benefit of markets. Thank you very much.
Thank you, Professor Eastley. And Professor Stiglitz has decided to lecture you from his seat. And Professor Stiglitz, you have as much as 12 minutes because he took 12 minutes. So take it away.
So let me first begin by the question, just remind you, is the best way to end global poverty free markets or government action? So first, you should understand, we're never going to end poverty. The Bible says, the poor you shall always have with you. So it's overreaching. But if you look at it historically, the single largest episode of the reduction of poverty in the history of mankind in a short span of time was in China. Over the last 35 years, where 740 million people have moved out of poverty as a result of government actions. Now, and this links with what Bill said, it was government using markets. So it was the move of the Chinese government to recognize that markets are an important instrument. And that's really highlights the what I would want to say is the essential message. You always are going to have a mixture of governments and markets. And the only success is going to be where you get the right mixture. I'll try to explain why I think you need probably a greater mixture of government than Bill does. That a lot of the failures are where that balance got wrong on the side of having too little government, that markets on their own pervasively, persistently fail to move people out of poverty or to achieve economic efficiency. But there are many instances of government failures as well. And so our objective has to be to try to construct efficient governments, not something we have in the United States, or governments that reflect rights, something that we are having a problem with right now. But also, we have to have markets that work well. So if we look at what region of the world there has been the most success in development, and development in particular that moves people out of poverty, it's not just China, it's really East Asia. And in all the East Asian countries, there was a large dose of government. They all used markets, and in fact, there's a whole literature talking about the way they restructure the markets, they govern the markets, and they made the markets work for their society. So they viewed markets not as an end in themselves, but as an instrument, and an instrument which helped move them in economic growth from very poor countries into moderately successful countries, in some cases quite successful, Japan being one of the more successful. Korea, when it began its development, had average education level of 4.3 years. Its income per capita was around $150. And today, it's one of the members of the Organization of Economic Cooperation and Development, one of the advanced countries, and leader in Samsung telephones and in lots of products and chips. And it was government-led development. On the other hand, the model that the World Bank used, I some of you may know I was the chief economist of the World Bank, and I had the unenviable task of trying to reform them. One of the later chief economists went on to say that my main success at the World Bank was actually changing the IMF, which was across the street. But the point is that at the time I came to the World Bank, the dominant ideology was called the Washington Consensus, which was based on a strong dose of the belief that markets worked well. And it permeated all of their policies. And it was in some ways driven by the belief that you needed to rebalance that in the direction that Bill said, to get more markets and less government. And the fact is that the countries that relied on the Washington Consensus were by and large unsuccessful, and much less successful than the East Asian countries, where they had a bigger dose of government. In fact, overall, the Washington Consensus policies, which were called structural adjustment in the context of Africa, actually led to the deindustrialization of Africa, and actually impeded. It led to a quarter century of stagnation. So there's going to be always a debate. Was the failure of Africa a result of too much government through marketing boards and agriculture? And that did play a role. Or was it, in fact, a result of the IMF coming in and insisting on the government government not doing things, leading to deindustrialization and a lost quarter century? And I'm much more of the latter view. Some argue that going forward, the mix in Africa should be tilted to markets because of the large governance problems in Africa. But if you go back to the period of the beginning of the East Asia miracle, the 1970s, 60s, 70s, 80s, what you see is that the governance in East Asia was far from perfect. And in fact, what happened in the Washington Consensus countries was it undermined the efforts to have a well-functioning state. So by eviscerating the state, it wasn't allowed to develop the institutions that make, you know, the systems of checks and balances, the kinds of institutions that make an effective democracy work. So by limiting the state, it actually eviscerated it and therefore weakened development. But even in Africa, among the most successful countries have been those where the state has taken a large role, the development state. And I don't want to claim that they are paragons of democratic values, but they have succeeded in reducing poverty. I don't know how many of you remember the pictures that you used to see on TV of young children starving in Ethiopia. You don't see those pictures anymore. And why was that? You know, what, is it a miracle of the markets? No. What happened was the government built infrastructure. And so it used to be that you'd have a famine in one region of the country, and you couldn't get the food over to the next. And that construction of infrastructure made a big difference. But it was also the the Ethiopia over the last about more than a decade now, 10, 15 years, has been growing at 12% a year, actually faster than China's growth, and its average growth rate was 10% a year over the 35-year period. That was because the Ethiopian government took a very active role in promoting development. They were trying to learn the lessons that had made East Asia successful and apply them to Africa. Botswana has had one of the longest periods of successful development, a small country. But there are Namibia has been very successful. And these are all countries that are successful in reducing poverty, and they because they've had a strong role for government. Some of them have a greater commitment to democracy than others. Namibia has actually a stronger commitment to press freedom than our president seems to have a commitment towards. It says whenever a contractor comes in, he invites the president and wants to discuss something, he invites the press in. And he says that discourages bad behavior. So he understands the president, the role of transparency. Well, the reason development state has been so successful is the preconditions for development are infrastructure, education, transfers of technology, health, all areas in which markets don't work well. And, this is about development, but I could mention, even in advanced countries, basic research, the development of the internet, rely on government. The discovery of DNA, if we had left it to the market, who knows when we would have had these advances. So all of these are things where, for good reason, economists have explained why markets don't work well. One has to understand that there are domains in which markets work, but there are others in which they don't work well. And even in advanced countries, unfettered markets don't work well. I think we learned in 2008 the need for regulation in the financial sector. There's a role for government in promoting investments in infrastructure and in R&D. And so even those are necessities in developed countries. It's even more in developing countries. And in terms of the broad framework of rights, one person's freedom is another person's unfreedom. You know, the right to have a gun to shoot somebody means that another person's freedom to live is being impaired. So that you can't look at these without looking at the balance of those. And so the bottom line is, while there are many examples of government failures, there are also many examples of market failures, and you need the balance of the two to get a society to function well.
Thank you, Joe. Yeah. We've allotted 20 minutes of dialogue and conversation between you two before we go to Q&A. I see that Professor Easterly has written a lot of notes, and so maybe we want to get you ask you to lead the discussion. I could ask a couple of questions and get it going, but I think you have a lot of provocative statements down there, so why don't you start? I wasn't, I swear. I just heard the scribbling, very loud scribbling.
Let's talk about Ethiopia. Let's think in terms of these channels of incentives, knowledge, and rights. So the problem with sort of government experts and aid experts also, which are in sort of in the same category, is that, first of all, they don't really have very strong incentives to get things right because they don't really get rewarded for getting things right or get punished for getting things wrong. As I can tell you from personal experience as a World Bank economist, I often got things wrong and got promoted for it. So, so the incentives are not very good. The knowledge is not very good. And the rights, the respective rights is not very good. So let's use Ethiopia as an example. Joe, you have a very good point about the infrastructure being a good thing for reducing poverty in Ethiopia and reducing famine. But the big picture is the famines in Ethiopia were happening during an extremely authoritarian regime called the Derg of a ruler who took the Soviet economy as a model how to run an economy, and that's when the famines happened during that Soviet period of Ethiopian policy. And the big revival of economic growth that Joe was talking about happened precisely when a new ruler came in and overthrew the Derg and brought in a much more market approach.
Do you want this to be a conversation, or do you want it to?
Well, I'm sorry.
I'll give you a chance. I'll give you a chance to respond.
I just want to pick up a word. Okay. Revival is not exactly the right word because prior to the Derg was Haile Selassie and two millennia of stagnation. So
I don't have all the data from two millennia, so okay, I was concentrating on the period.
One minute, the famines
that you referred to, the famous famines in 85. In
but they were there before that too.
Yes, yeah. There were famines under Haile Selassie too. Yes. So. Yeah, so there's more going on than just the only thing being the... I concede that point. Thank you, Joe. But so the only problem with the new regime in Ethiopia is it still was infatuated with many state solutions that did not work out that well. So let me give you another example of knowledge kind of misfiring. They thought a great idea would be a program called Villagization that was started in 2012... and that involved the forced resettlement, so also a failure to respect rights. And unfortunately, the aid experts also endorsed this approach and showed a shocking disregard for the property rights of Ethiopian farmers who were being forcibly resettled in the government model villages that the government thought would be better for them, except the model villages didn't have, like, water for their cattle, didn't have fields that were fertile. They were much worse than the villages that they were forcibly resettled from that they had freely chosen. And a lot of the victims of this policy in the province of Gambela wound up fleeing into refugee camps into Kenya, and one of them made his way to Britain and sued the British Aid Agency for supporting all this stupid stuff. So, you know, that's a good example of how incentives are wrong, knowledge is faulty, and there's a shocking respect for the rights of poor people involved in a lot of these state sort of and aid expert kind of coercive solutions.
On Ethiopia, Professor, a chance to respond to the general remarks about Ethiopia.
Yeah. As I said, you know, there's going to be mistakes in any system. No government ever was a result of so much economic damage as the collapse of our financial system, which cost U.S. $5 trillion and Europe $5 trillion. So I don't want to say there's any monopoly on inefficiency and failure. But if you look in the case of Ethiopia, and I've spent a lot of time there, the fact is that they did correct these mistakes. And that's why over a long period of time, they had an average of 12% growth rates. You know, they do make mistakes, absolutely. And sometimes it takes them longer than it should. And during this particular period, there were violations of rights, and that's also clear. But they had an understanding that you're not going to have an accumulation of knowledge unless you have education systems. And people were so poor that they couldn't have private education. And when you have private education, you wind up with Trump University. So and remember, America's private schools, we call private universities, are all not-for-profit. They're not based on the profit model. The only private ones are the exploited private ones that don't deliver an education for anybody.
Do you want to make a remark about Ethiopia?
About Ethiopia. Yeah. And I think, you know, all these, you know, development is really difficult. It did succeed over this long period of time of really doubling. You know, remember, if you grow at 12% a year for 10, 12 years, you multiply incomes by fourfold. That's a big deal when you have a very poor country. You move a lot of people out of poverty. If you go to Addis, you see what has been done. And again, it's too soon to tell, but the big success of getting a new government that has released people out of prisons, that has really moved very big democratic strides, is evidence that over time these things not only show up in terms of reducing poverty, but also even are having fruits in terms of a movement towards, towards democracy and human rights.
Well, I agree with you, Joe. The mechanism for correcting mistakes in Ethiopia was a massive popular protest that got rid of the old government doing all these stupid things and brought in the new government you're talking about that is promising liberalization and enhanced freedom for Ethiopian citizens. I want to comment also quickly on this point that writes that my freedom could be someone else's unfreedom. I don't think that's a... I think the correct understanding of freedom is that we can all reach a mutually consistent understanding of our own zone of personal freedoms that we're all willing to respect for each other. And so that a proper understanding of freedom that we see most exemplified in market transactions is that freedom is not a zero-sum game. It's not a zero-sum game where more freedom for me means less freedom for you. More freedom for all of us means that we can all engage in mutually beneficial transactions through social interactions, through markets, through all based on the understanding that we all have our own zone of personal respect for our rights and personal liberty and property rights and contract rights and human rights, all those zones of freedom. Those are a big positive-sum game. These are not something that we achieve at the expense of each other. These are something that we all achieve together for mutually beneficial transactions through markets.
Yeah, when they're well regulated. The point is, if we don't have adequate regulation, you have a financial sector that can impose costs on the rest of us. Our economy goes down. We suffer $5 trillion. And that's why we get together in collective action and say, that system didn't work very well. We need to have a different set of regulations. And then you have to also understand that there are large asymmetries of information. There are people that can exploit other people. There is market power. You know, Adam Smith was talking about a competitive economy. That's what he said is what delivers efficiency. But remember, another quote of Adam Smith is that, you know, businessmen seldom get together without conspiring against the public good. And what he was talking about was market power and the antitrust laws were designed to address that. But you need regulations because otherwise you wind up with market power. And when you have market power, you don't get the benefits of a market economy. So, I mean, I could go down lots of other lists. There's a very nice book by George Akerlof and Rob Schiller called Fishing for Fools, and they use the word PH from the internet. Yeah. And the point is that firms make as much profits, it's easier to make profits by looking around the world for fools that you can exploit rather than making a better innovation. And if the government says you can't do that, you can't engage in abusive credit card practices, you can't make unsafe products, that the dangers of which only get discovered too late, those kind of regulations then encourage people to actually direct their energy at innovating for things that actually increase societal value.
Okay. So, Joe, I get your point. I mean, it's certainly true that in markets you can have things like inside information that could lead to deception and cheating of one party by another that would violate the whole idea of mutually beneficial transactions. But it seems like you're imagining a kind of idealized government that can fly in and rescue this situation. The problem is government regulators also have... I mean, if you want to talk about fools, I would talk about the people who are in power in Washington at the moment.
No,
that's
look at
the,
as I say,
a great nomination for the biggest collection of fools that I know of.
Anybody,
once you give power to governments to regulate, if you give them a lot of power to regulate, then you know that power is going to be inherited by a group of fools like what we have in Washington at the moment.
So
there is no idealized government savior who's going to fly in who's got, again, do they have the right incentives to get it right?
Sure.
Do they have the knowledge to get it right? Do they really respect the rights that were being violated by cheating? That's the questions we have to be asking.
So anybody who's living through the United States right now knows about government failure. So and that's across the political spectrum. So that seems we can agree on that. Yeah. The question, though, is Shakespeare said, to err is human. All human institutions are fallible. And the question is, how do you create a system that works the best? And that involves within our government checks and balances and within our society checks and balances. And those checks and balances have the market checking government and the government checking markets and civil society involved in checking both. So if I ask, would I rather have imperfect environmental regulation or what we had before we had environmental regulations where people were dying in Los Angeles from pollution, I would rather have imperfect regulation. I don't think I want the world to fry from global climate change, which is what we would have if we don't have any government regulation. So it seems to me that, we have no choice but to say at least in some areas you need regulation. Let me go back to another example back in the beginning of the 20th century.
Let me just clarify again. That's a straw man to say that anyone advocating markets believes in zero government intervention to correct something like an environmental pollution problem. So obviously we agree on that.
Yeah.
Could
let me talk about food regulation. The reason we began having...
Why are we talking about the U.S. so much? I thought we were...
These are general principles.
Global poverty. Developing countries.
Yeah. The reason we have food regulation is because Upton Sinclair wrote a very forceful book called The Jungle, in which he showed what happens, what the meatpackers were like. And people didn't want to eat meat. And they came to the government and said, give us some assurance that we're not going to die when we eat beef. And it worked for a while. Now we shouldn't eat beef because of what it does to the environment. But that's another matter. But in developing countries, what I was saying is, East Asia did not have perfect institutions. But yet, they were able to do better than historically any group of countries had ever done in terms of economic growth, in terms of development, and in terms of moving people out of poverty. And they're not perfect institutions they have. They had instances of corruption. They corrected them. What I guess I'm arguing, you need these checks and balances, and you need an important role for government.
May I try to join the issue and ask? I seem to like the divide between you two is that Bill Easterly is saying that in crucial respects, government is far more fallible than markets with respect to issues of development. And so you're not, Bill. So maybe you want to defend that point and then let Joe respond. Why is government more fallible than markets? Elaborate for a moment.
Well, again, I remember especially if you're giving the government a lot of power to determine the development strategy, then the problem with that is the elites in any society can take advantage of that power, can capture the state, and then use that power to oppress the rest of the society. So we have to talk about politics again, which is the problem with the idealized government to the rescue model.
And what is the advantage of
markets? There's an old joke about this someone says the problem with our government is that they're completely captured by the corporations. The corporations run the government. And then they ask, what is the solution to, how do we solve this problem? Well, the government will solve it. The corporate-dominated government that is alleged to exist is not going to solve the problem of government being dominated by corporate.
But what are the checks and balances in markets? They elaborate for that.
The markets inherently have, I personally refuse to eat poisonous meat, so that helps kind of keep the meat producers in check. My whole family refuses to buy poisonous meat in the market, so that's a kind of natural market force that tends to be a check on meat producers, not to poison all of us. So there's some built-in incentives in markets that you can only prosper in markets if you satisfy the consumer. So the consumer has power over the producers. That's the other great invisible hand celebrated by Adam Smith, the invisible hand of consumers searching for the best possible deal, the best possible price for the best possible quality. And that also brings in lots of knowledge. Consumers have an incentive, the firms have an incentive to know what really is in the meat. And so, there will be a search for, what are really the ingredients in the meat. And there will be, even firms will come to exist that test the meat and that advertise what. And so there are some natural market solutions to these problems that have better built-in incentives than the government does, governments which can be captured by elites and not act in the interests of the citizenry.
Oh, you want to respond? Go ahead. Take it away. Respond.
Well, so first let me say, talking about Adam Smith, if you read the body of Adam Smith, he had a much more nuanced...
I actually recently read both The Whole Theory of Moral Settlements
including
The Whole
Theory
Wealth
of Moral
of Nations.
Settlements. And the point is,
he has
a much more nuanced view.
Have you read the whole
thing? I'm not read, but I've read enough of it to know he was aware of the monopoly power. He was aware of the importance of government in education, the importance of government in lots of other areas. You quoted and he was writing in particular before the modern innovation age. Now, why do I say that's important? Because information and knowledge is what we think of as quintessentially a public good. That if each of us had to do research about whether every producer of beef was safe or not, we couldn't operate. And yes, you could have private agencies do the inspection, but then we start worrying about the incentives of those private agencies. An example of that is the credit rating agencies. They were doing, quote, evaluation, but they were being paid by the banks, and their incentives were perverse. And that monitoring function doesn't work very well in the private sector, except in a few instances, and that's why people have turned to government to look for meat and for financial sector regulation. So, and in a modern economy where knowledge is so important, with the production of the knowledge itself of value to everybody in society, you're going to have a significant government to do research about DNA, to do a lot of the basic innovations that are necessary for a knowledge economy to function, like the internet, as an example.
Before we go to Q&A, I just wanted for you both to address the issue of China. Joe brought it up, the biggest success story, China. My question to you, Joe, is do you think right now that the mix between government power and market power is about right in China? They about have it right? Do they need more market or more government in China?
Oh, I think they need more market.
More market, okay. Okay, and then I guess you agree, but maybe want to comment on that.
China is a good way to, again, I keep having the feeling, Joe, that you keep going back to this idealized government that is going to...
No, it's not idealized. I just said, as a matter of fact,
that the government
they did
agency,
move 740 million people out of poverty. That was the question we were asked. What was most successful? And no private market has ever done anything like that.
When the government let a market economy emerge after lots of protests by farmers on collective farms, there was a big transition from a planned economy to a market economy. That's the big
not,
thing we
it's
both
still not
agree
a market
on.
Economy.
Yeah.
All right. Let me make one final point.
Again, challenging the sort of idealized government to the rescue thing is even more of a problem in very poor countries that have very adverse conditions due to history and the legacy of previous bad colonial institutions. To have a clean, you know, what knowledgeable government fixing all of these problems. The idea that a state agency would kind of get it right and be honest is under great threat in a poor economy with poor institutions where there's serious problems of corruption, elite capture, all the things we've been talking about that take us very far away from a government being a good solution to these, a kind of panacea for these problems that we're talking about.
Okay, thank you, Joe. Okay, we have 30 minutes for Q&A. Please line up. Please try to phrase your question as a question. And then tell us, of course, if your question is at either of the two parties, that's fine. If your question is directed to Professor Stiglitz or Professor Easterly, say so. First questioner, please. Yeah, go ahead. Please ask a question. Yeah, go ahead.
Hi, yeah. My question is for Professor Stiglitz about Venezuela. In 2006, you wrote that then-President Hugo Chavez was unfairly castigated for being populist, and I'm quoting, aimed to bring education and health benefits to the poor and to strive for economic policies that not only bring higher growth but also ensure that the fruits of the growth are more widely shared. When you were in Venezuela the following year, at a time when President Chavez was being criticized by the World Bank and had already been cited by Human Rights Watch for abuses, according to news reports, you met with Chavez and were quoted making positive comments about him. Based on the PowerPoint presentation still available for download on your website, you also gave a speech sponsored by the Bank of Venezuela where you criticized so-called market fundamentalism and cited your own research showing how Adam Smith was wrong. 11 years later, Chavez's policies have led millions to flee the country, and as Professor Easterly mentioned, there are people starving to death in what was once among the richest countries in Latin America. My question is as follows. Has Venezuela's economic collapse led you to reconsider your views on the role of government in managing trade, currency, exchange rates, and keeping inflation in check? And are you concerned that your endorsements back in 2006 and 2007 bolstered the credibility of the Venezuelan government?
So, first, I did not endorse...
Thank you for not reading my old quotes.
What? What did you say?
No. If you notice what I said, I did not endorse him. What I said is that the focus on education and health was commendable. The fact is that Venezuela was the richest country in Latin America, and yet in all this period, while it was before Chavez, as it was the richest country, two-thirds of the country was in poverty. And it was that which gave rise to the feeling among large numbers of the people that something ought to be done. And Chavez offered, for the first time, the hope, which he did not deliver on, that something would be done about education and health for the vast majority. The previous governments had not done that. They focused on taking the wealth of the country and giving it to the elites, the small group in the top who were doing very well. Now, obviously, it's been an utter disaster of what has happened. Nobody can defend Maduro and what has happened and the loss of Reichs, nor can anybody defend the undermining of the democratic institutions that even happened during the latter years of Chavez. I think what I was emphasizing was just the fact that in this period prior to Chavez, all this wealth of the country was being used for the benefit of very few people at the top. And it just was a scandal that two-thirds of the population were in poverty.
Well, in all fairness, I think the quote also was that you wrote in your book that Chavez had a commitment to higher growth.
And that, he wanted to do it. He didn't deliver.
Did you feel he was really doing it? Okay.
But at the time,
the Economic Freedom Index was slashing. The World Bank was saying that his policies are destructive. They're already saying that at the time that you were endorsing.
I was not endorsing his macro policies. Yeah. I was very clear. It was just the focus on education and health.
But how about commitment to higher growth?
He wanted to get higher growth. In the end, it turned out that he didn't know how to do it.
Okay.
And you got
negative growth, as we economists say, in the neoliberalism. But I guess you answered the question. Bill, do you have any comment on the question about Venezuela and Joe's endorsement? Joe's role.
I haven't read any of your old quotes on Venezuela, so I have nothing to say on that. I think this is an example of this discussion we're having about the Washington Consensus. I mean, I think the Washington Consensus, what it got wrong was it was a big attempt to sort of coerce other countries into adopting the advice of IMF and World Bank experts, which is the worst possible way to sell any program of reform, and it led to this kind of backlash that resulted in Chavez and resulted in Evo Morales and Bolivia and Daniel Ortega coming back in Nicaragua and things like that. But elsewhere, there were sort of homegrown efforts towards economic reform that were moving away from the kind of bad things that are happening in Venezuela now. Venezuela has extremely high rates of inflation, extremely high black market premium of exchange rates, of the black market exchange rate much higher than the official exchange rate. It's fairly destroyed international trade. So measures of these things elsewhere in the world have resulted in, first of all, when those things are bad, there's always, almost always, very negative growth. And when those things are corrected, as they were in the aftermath of the Washington Consensus, like in large parts of Africa and Latin America, there actually was a very strong positive growth response to those reforms that corrected those extreme distortions of markets. And so I think Venezuela is a counterfactual that reminds us of what would have happened in a world without this movement towards market reform. That market reform is actually much more of a success, and where it hasn't happened, there's been great failure.
The structural adjustment programs in Africa led to a quarter century of stagnation. That I viewed was a big failure. You know, 25 years of no growth.
Can we be precise about this? So there was bad growth in the 80s through the mid-90s. During that period, inflation was still extremely high. Black market premiums were still extremely high. Real interest rates were negative, destroying financial markets. And then after the mid-90s, in most African countries, those things were finally corrected, and then growth did revive after the mid-90s in Africa up to the present. And there's been now 20 years of very positive growth in the aftermath of correcting those distortions. So the kind of stagnation you're talking about was when the market distortions were still extremely severe, and when they were finally corrected, then growth did revive.
All right.
This is a technical discussion, because I think actually the growth revives. The most important part of the growth revival was actually as a result of China's ascendance, demand for natural resources going up, and the price of natural resources going up was a real boost to Africa. And that's, if you look at what made the difference for most of the African countries, that's where it really showed up.
So there's the context. Do you think that Africa, the government oppression of the economy lifted and growth happened? And Joe's.
Yeah, and then the rest of Latin America.
And what I'm saying is, if you look at the data, it deindustrialized as a result of the, you know, that in, even in like 2014, the fraction of GDP output and employment that was in, say, manufacturing, industrial, in Africa was lower than in the 1970s. So it was a long period where, rather than leading to the next stage of development, they were really frozen. And so they did so that they really didn't get onto a viable growth path that would have led to reduction of poverty, except in places where there were lots of natural resources, and in places like Ethiopia, Namibia, where they really had more active government policies to promote growth.
Yes. Question. Go ahead.
Francis Menton of the Manhattan.
Don't have to identify yourself. Just ask the question. We don't care who you are. Ask the question.
Okay. Well, one of the things I do for my
Joe and I care who you are.
Yes, you do. One of the things I do for my website is study statistics, relative statistics of personal income on the one hand versus the Freedom Index on the other hand. And if you study those things, you quickly realize a very huge correlation between Freedom Indexes on the one hand, the freedom to start a business, the freedom to own property, and the wealth and success of the country. So you look at the most free countries, you get your United States is near the top, Singapore, Australia, New Zealand at the bottom, you get your Venezuela, your Haiti, your North Korea. And in the middle, you get places like China. Oh, their per capita income is lower than Mexico, lower than Brazil, lower than South Korea, lower than Taiwan. And I guess my question is, if we're looking to eliminate poverty and increase wealth, shouldn't we be looking to follow the model of the places that succeed rather than following the model of the places that fail or have mediocre performance?
Well, that kind of analysis yes. ignores the role of history. You know, it'd be nice to wipe out colonialism, wipe out but the fact is that China in 1949 or even in later, it had a per capita income of $100, $150, and nothing you could do, you could give them complete freedom, and that's not going to change. If you gave them the U.S. Freedom Index, they're not going to go from $100 to $50,000 overnight. You ask, what about the growth rate? That's what's, in terms of what, with economic analysis, what is the growth rate? And here, the economic evidence is mixed. There are lots of people do regressions, but if you asked, and there are lots of problems of doing these correlations, let me just say, but for instance, if you treat China's provinces as separate countries, as an example, and each of those provinces have 50 million or 100 million, so they're big countries, you get a very different result than if you treat China as one data point. And so you really have to be careful when you do those correlations. The fact is that China has been the most successful in terms of growth involving large numbers of people over a 40-year period.
Comment for you, Joe?
No, I think you're right. I think the level of freedom is a good predictor of the level of prosperity, and that's certainly supportive of the idea that market freedoms are very conducive to prosperity. And then I think the other thing that you're talking about, Joe, is then you want to start matching changes and changes. The change in prosperity is called the growth rate, as you're talking about. And China itself is a good example. When you did finally give Chinese people a lot more market freedoms, then there was indeed the greatest economic boom in world history. So that seems supportive of the idea that more freedom goes with more prosperity in changes as well as in levels, as what you were talking about.
You want to comment?
Oh, just saying that it is true that moving from the extremes that they had of market control, was important. But the government in the period from 1978 on, especially in the first 25 years after those reforms, the government still had a very large control. But let me make it very clear, you know, particularly for advanced countries, there's absolutely no doubt that more freedom, better, you know, in an appropriate way, with a well-regulated system, government providing basic institutional infrastructure, hard infrastructure, investments in technology, are going to do well and going to do better. But that's not what we're talking about right now. We're really talking about in these earlier stages of development. Did strong countries with strong government policies, where the government played an important role, did they do a particularly strong role in reducing poverty?
But with respect to China, I think you earlier said, in answer to my question, that you actually do believe that China doesn't have the mix right and that it actually does need more market reforms than it has now. So you want it to move in the direction of more market reforms.
Yeah.
Okay. And final comment? No. Okay. Question.
Professor Stiglitz, Professor Easterly, great discussion. I like the fact that it was a discussion. It takes away the air of antagonism, even though you guys have had your moments.
We do debates here, but please ask your question. Yeah.
Okay. Gene, you always try to rush me, and
make nice with the guys, but do it afterwards.
Of course. Yeah. Right. I understand. Okay, I love you, Gene. I love Soho Forum.
Love you, too.
And Nick.
Yeah. Go ahead.
Okay. But first, a little bit about myself.
Oh, okay. Okay.
You guys have spoken generally about some sort of mixture between an intervention-based market society. But if you guys could be a little specific, each of you, what is the aspect or aspects of the other's point of view that you find most indispensable, most beneficial? Because I think it's about common ground, and maybe if you guys found common ground, that's a place that we could start.
Say something nice about Bill. Joe, say something. Please.
You go first, Joe.
Well, I think I've been saying nice things.
Even nicer.
I think, as I said, markets play an important role in any successful society. I think the points that Bill has made that markets, the decentralization of markets, the opportunity for lots of people to be involved, is an important component to success. The scope it gives for individual entrepreneurship is both important for individuals themselves flourishing and for society. It's only that I also think you need a framework in which that occurs. Just to mention one other, you have to have contract enforcement, and you have to have rules of the game. And how you set those rules of the game, markets don't exist in a vacuum, and you have to have those rules set somehow. And so even the idea that you could have markets without government is almost absurd. You have a jungle without government.
Well, I mean, the Economic Freedom Index has the enforcement of property rights in line with what you said. Enforcement of property rights, which is important. But go ahead, Bill, say something nice.
You already said it. So I completely agree with you, Joe. Contract
on everything.
Contract enforcement, honest courts, police. There are obvious things that are public goods that you do need government, of course, and you've made that point very eloquently with your usual grace.
Okay, that's it. They said something nice. Next question.
Good evening. I own and operate a business in my native country of Senegal in West Africa. And I also happen to believe that the only way...
You can identify yourself.
No, we don't know.
Bill, don't do that.
Your question is for whom? To Dr. Toom?
They will find out.
Okay, sure.
So I continue. I also happen to believe that the only route out of poverty for my people in Senegal is by allowing businesses to have the kind access to the kind of same economic freedom that we see in the Fraser Institute's Economic Freedom Index. So my question is, Mr. Stiglitz, do you agree with that? And if not, could you please tell me where would your bridge with the economic freedom of businesses?
I guess I don't know all the components to the Economic Freedom Index, so I can't really respond to that. I mean, obviously, so I just can't, without knowing. If you want to ask me about any particular freedoms that you want to...
No, I guess it's a bit troubling for me that when we are standing here and talking about do free markets help countries get out of poverty or not, I do think that the Fraser Institute's economic freedom is a very important one. I'm asking my question this way because I took it for granted you would know about it.
Okay, then Bill, you want to take that question? Because maybe you know more about it. You once had your name on a Fraser Institute publication in 2006, Economic Freedom, so maybe you want to comment.
Now you're finding my old quotes. Okay. So I don't know what you want me to do.
On the Economic Freedom Index and its importance, what's your view?
I like the Economic Freedom Index. It's a very heroic effort to put everything in one index to measure the extent of market freedom, and I think it is correlated in levels and changes with prosperity, and that's again supportive evidence for the role of markets in relieving poverty, like Mike Otwade was talking about just now.
Thank you. Okay, next question.
I'd like to ask this question to all the members on the stage. Professor Stiglitz, why should I not believe that economic power will, especially over the long run, come to dominate public power, therefore leading to oligopoly in the economy and anything but democracy? So why should I not believe that? Why should I not believe that? I see it everywhere. I mean, I see everywhere. As you said, the governments are under the control of the economic power. That's what I see everywhere.
Yeah, I think you're raising a very difficult and very troubling issue that actually there are a number of books are trying to grapple with, that in the absence of constraints, the point that there is a tendency for an agglomeration of economic power, and it's been made worse, I think, with some of the new technologies. I think we've been very innovative in ways of enhancing and extending market power. So market power has actually gotten much worse. There's lots of evidence that market power has gotten worse in the United States and in many other countries. And the only curb on market power is government. And that was what we recognized in the antitrust laws in the end of the last 19th century, in the beginning of the 20th. And when they passed those laws, it wasn't about economics or just economics. They realized that this concentration of market power would inevitably undermine democracy. And it has. And there is a growing concern, a book that just recently came out, gotten a lot of attention and debate, Democracy in Chains, for instance, argued that the response of the fear democracies would naturally try to curb this kind of market power, and that the response of the concentration, those at the top of the concentration of market power, is therefore to undermine democracy and to curb democracy, to put it in chains. And so You get efforts at disenfranchisement, disempowerment, constraining democratic space for democratic action and undermining democracy. I think that those are real concerns, and I think we're seeing a play out, a lot of this being played out today in our democracy.
Bill Lisa, you want to comment? No.
Well, there's something that puzzles me about this line of argument. I mean, not just you, Joe, but many commentators have these positions that, and I agree that there is a real concern that government can be captured by economic power, and then the monopolies will become much worse when they're protected by government, you know, when the government is going to cooperate with economic monopolies to limit entry into those industries or to give them the benefit of trade protection or whatever they want. That's when economic power is at its worst. And so, you know, there is a fear that government and democracy could be captured by the economic power. But then how can you say at the same time that the government is the answer to regulating these?
Yeah,
more government regulation is the answer if the government has already been captured by private interests. I don't get the consistency
so
of those two positions.
The consistency is the following. There are two points. In our original antitrust laws, we, in a sense, democratized our antitrust laws, and we said you could have private suits because we were worried precisely about capture. So that's why we have civil action, as we have, as well as criminal action. We have state antitrust. So we have going from many, many different directions. And an important, in a global economy, one of the checks, say, against the big tech giants is that there are other countries where they don't have the same influence that they do in the United States. So that's one set of answers. The other one is that while there's a lot of influence, power, and structure, episodically people get fed up and they go to the polls and they demand a change, hopefully before it's too late. And that's what happened in the passage of the antitrust laws at the end of the 19th century. They said, we're going in this direction. We can still get our democracy back by curtailing the agglomeration of a power, of market power. And they got it back. So there was an awful lot of influence, but they changed the direction for a long time.
We have time for one final question. Please ask your question. This won't just has to be a final question. Yeah.
Professor Stiglitz, if you look at government, the weaknesses often are corruption, the influence, the fact that the politicians and the bureaucrats work what's in their interest, which doesn't always coincide with the interest of the public and good policy for growth. And the election box is not always a perfect remedy for that. Under what conditions do you see government really functioning for the benefit of growth? And what are those times, and how do you deal with those problems when they do not, because of the problems I indicated and other difficulties? And for Professor Easterly, when you look at the private markets, one of the problems is, of course, managers are different than the owners of a business in modern-day society in many cases. So you have a short-termism that sometimes creates problems, which, of course, also exist in government in terms of elections. And then you also have the difficulty of the fact that the market is a matter of survival of the fittest, and those who are at the bottom sometimes have a little trouble in those markets where the government might have a role in improving the conditions, as Professor Stiglitz has indicated. What do you see as those solutions to the type of problems that exist with the corporate sector and the private sector, which don't involve government creating more problems? And in both cases, particularly in the case of Professor Stiglitz, how do you deal with the problem that simple solutions to problems overlook the consequences that will follow that are not direct and can cause more harm?
I think that's a perfect question for you gentlemen to feel inspired in your final summations. I'm glad you both took notes. So, Bill Easterly, you have your 5 minutes of summation, and Joe gets to be cleanup hitter. So, Bill, you want to take the podium for your 5 minutes of summation? Okay. Thank you.
So, let's talk about some good news. In the last 25 years, the global poverty rate has fallen from 70% of the world's population living in poverty to now 30% of the world's population living in poverty, and it's still going down. And Joe said correctly that there will be some degree of poverty for a very long time, but the most extreme levels of poverty are actually vanishing before our eyes with the growth of the global economy. How is that happening? It's going on. We are experiencing one of the greatest booms of international trade, capital flows, and migration in world history. The freedom to transact in markets through through both migrating, trading, investing worldwide, people matching freely with each other to realize positive sum gains of interaction through markets is creating remarkable opportunities. We have Egyptians exporting ceramic toilets to Italy. That's one of my favorite examples of specializations. Who is the development expert who had said, the answer is more toilets for Italy? I have not found one that said that. Filipinos sending electronic integrated circuits to the United States. Nigerians exporting floating docks to Norway. Entrepreneurs from Lesotho export cotton trousers to American men, while Fijians send cotton suits to American women. This remarkable specialization in the world economy of international trade has created opportunities worldwide for poor people to get out of poverty. And it's the greatest success story of one of the greatest success stories of our era. And that's, I want to just revisit again the idea that the one reason markets work so well is because of these three channels that they get right. That they get right the incentive of both consumers to find the best bargain and find things that work for them, that they get to say what solves their problems by operating in a market. The gentleman just now mentioned correctly that the consumers at the bottom may not have enough money to meet all of their needs. The answer to that is not dismantle markets and have government take over. The answer to that is some simple solutions that have already been verified in some development work and evidence that cash transfers to the poor will alleviate some of those problems to enable poor people to meet some of their basic needs. Again, this answer is simple. Give them cash and let them then choose them for themselves in markets what works for them. So markets get those incentives right. Markets get the knowledge right that the people at the bottom, both entrepreneurs and consumers, know best what solves their own problems. And lastly, this point that's very important to me, we've talked a little bit today about rights. I just want to stress again that markets in our own day have shown themselves to be the historically the most unprecedented system that has ever been known in our world today for allowing peoples that are otherwise, states that are otherwise seemingly at each other's throats in terms of state rivalry, the peoples like Iran and Russia and the U.S. and all of these and Middle Eastern nations. But in the meantime, the peoples of these nations are engaged in peaceful, mutually beneficial transactions through migration and trade and investment. And it's right. It's not perfect. It's not flawless. It's not utopia. But it's the best we've ever seen in world economic history that has led indeed to that great decrease in poverty that I mentioned. And that's something we should really celebrate that markets have achieved. Thank you very much.
By pointing out that this dichotomy between markets and government is a little bit phony, that in fact every successful society has to have both markets and government, and it's really getting the right balance between the two. And I would add more than just markets and government, it's about civil society. And the reason I see all these is together is that it's a system of checks and balances that in the absence of one, you can get the problems that have been identified in the other. So it's when you say we've been successful over the last numerous years of moving people out of poverty, and it's because we have a variety of mixed systems, and the particular mixture at that particular moment in China, where there was a lot of government, is they focused not just on growth, but making sure that that benefit of growth was reflected in a movement out of poverty. There are other places where there's been growth, but that growth didn't do as much of a job of moving people out of poverty. The last question I thought was very much to the point, where it pointed out what economists call is the basic principal agent problem, the basic problem that the managers of firms don't really maximize the well-being of large enterprises, the long-run well-being of the corporations, or let alone society as a whole. And the elected officials don't always maximize the well-being of our country. They have their own agenda. There are what we call incentive misalignments that are pervasive in our society. And they would be less severe if we have perfect information, but we don't have perfect information. And so in the presence of these imperfections of information, they are going to be part of our society. Therefore, we have to try to learn how to make each of our parts of our system work and work better. And when they do, we can get a more efficient system, but also we can get a system, going back to the question, that delivers more out of poverty. And in societies where there hasn't been that kind of growth, like right now in India, they're very successful in creating billionaires, but much less successful in moving people out of poverty. And so unless you have a kind of balance where you can make sure that there is growth and that some of the fruits of that growth go to the people at the bottom, you won't have an effective way of addressing inequality. And in the long run, you won't even have strong economic growth.
Thank you, Joe.
Thank you.